Sam has asked me to read Psalm 139 in preparation for this session. Hear now the word of God. To the choir master, a psalm of David. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You hem me in behind and before and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me and the light about me be night. Even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you. When I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I would count them, they are more than the sand. I awake and I am still with you. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. O men of blood, depart from me. They speak against you with malicious intent. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with complete hatred. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. May the Lord bless the reading of his word. Let's turn now to him in prayer and ask for his help as we give ourselves to the further study of his word. Our God and our Father, we thank you for the word that you've given to us in which you declare yourself to us. You offer yourself to us in covenant grace. You've made yourself known to your people, and we pray that our hearts would know you, that our minds, as we are being instructed this afternoon, will not simply look for reservoirs to be filled up with new knowledge, but that the greater knowledge of you and your decree and from all of eternity would lead us to greater doxology, would cause us to draw near to you as you draw near to us. What our desire is to know you as you have made yourself known, and not as we may have invented you in our own minds. Would you correct us and see if there are ways in us, grievous ways in us, where our thinking about you and about your eternal decree is wrong, and correct us and put us on the right path. Cause us to know the true and living God. Through Christ your Son, by the power of your Spirit, we ask it. Amen.
I once had the good fortune of taking a class on our confession of faith from Dr. James Renahan. You may know him. I got to take it with my brother, too. So we had a good time. One of the things that my dad likes to point out in the confession, and rightly so, is that in any given chapter, it's often the case that it leads with a very thick or dense, packed statement that is then unpacked or further explained throughout the rest of the chapter. And that is the case in chapter 3, that it starts out with big claims and thick, densely packed assertions. And then these things are worked out and explained further in the rest of the chapter. That doesn't mean that every paragraph is necessarily specifically unpacking the first paragraph, but it often works in that way, that the confession or the paragraphs are front-loaded with the the broadest and the most intense statements, which is why these first lectures are also the most intense and the most detailed. So today, or excuse me, not today, now in this lesson, we are going to look at the rest of paragraph 1. In the previous lesson, we just looked at the first part of it. And so now we want to look at the rest of paragraph 1. And I want to read it, all of paragraph 1, make a few introductory comments, and then get into the outline itself. So if you have a copy of the confession or the hymnal or your phone, I'm going to read chapter 3, paragraph 1 from our confession of faith. We confess, God hath decreed in himself from all eternity, by the most wise and holy counsel of his own will, freely and unchangeably, all things, whatsoever comes to pass. Yet, so as thereby is God neither the author of sin, nor hath fellowship with any therein, nor is violence offered to the will of the creature, nor yet is the liberty or contingency of second causes taken away, but rather established, in which appears his wisdom in disposing all things, and power and faithfulness in accomplishing his decree. God has decreed all things whatsoever comes to pass. As soon as you say that, that's when all the hands go up. Wait, what a bit? What about, what about, what about, what about? All the whatabouts and the what ifs and the but why and all these things immediately are provoked in the mind. And the confession immediately addresses a variety of the questions or concerns or doubts or challenges that one might have in response to such a vast and sweeping statement as, God has decreed all things whatsoever comes to pass. In fact, the rest of the paragraph is addressing these challenges or these concerns and questions. You see it there in the word, yet. God hath decreed all things whatsoever comes to pass, yet. And then there's a series of qualifications that follow. There's really four basic assertions that the confession makes in defense of the initial argument. It says that God is not the author of sin. It says that God has no fellowship in the sin of sinners. It says that God's decree does not take away the liberty or contingency of second causes, but rather God's decree establishes the liberty and contingency of second causes. But I want you to notice with me something, namely that the confession merely asserts these truths. It does not say much by way of their proof or defense. And remember that assertions are not arguments. So the confession says that God has decreed all things, yet is not the author of sin. You could very easily respond and say, well, why not? The confession says that God has decreed all things, yet has no fellowship in the sin of sinners. You could say, well, why not? You see, the confession asserts, but does not argue. Am I criticizing the confession? No. Because why? The confession is not a systematic theology. It's a summary statement. It's a statement of the conclusions. The confession is all of the conclusions of theology. It's the summary assertions, the summary affirmations, the summary confessions of faith that we make. And so in order to understand those assertions, you really need to understand what they are of what iceberg are they the tip? That's the question you have to ask. Because they're conclusions. They're assertions, and they often don't include the arguments because if it did, it would cease to be a confession of faith and it would be a systematic theology. So for us, what we need to do, and for any serious student of the confession, is you need to, as much as you can from a study of the cited scriptures and any and all related resources, contemporary resources from the time of the confession and the time leading up to the confession, you have to use all of that to reconstruct the conceptual framework that leads to these assertions and these conclusions. And then you get the arguments, then you get the defense, then you get the proof of what is asserted in the confession. So this is not in any way a criticism of the confession. It's a recognition of what the confession is and is not, and looking at these things more fully in order to prove and explain why the confession says what it says. So we have initially this statement that God has decreed all things. Then you have a few qualifications, but they're more asserted than argued. They're more proffered than proved, or proposed than proved. So to investigate this more fully, As you can see in the outline, I want to look at four headings. And again, there's a lot of details, a lot of terms, a lot of distinctions, but I'm giving it to you so that you can follow as easily as possible. And hopefully the outline helps you to engage rather than disengaging because, well, I can look at the outline later. I hope that's not the case. So consider with me in the first place, divine ideas and evil. Divine ideas and evil. It may seem like a flat contradiction to say that God decrees all things whatsoever comes to pass, yet also to say he's not the author of sin. Someone could look at those two things and say, that's nonsense. How do those two things consist? How do they cohere? How do they hold together? Well, it's helpful to think of at a bare minimum, you should understand the confession must have a reason. There must be some logic underlying something that appears on the surface to be contradictory. And of course, there is. So consider with me the divine ideas, which we discussed in the previous lesson. We have already said that God knows himself. And because God knows himself and all that he can create that would imitate or image his perfection, these are the divine ideas. All the good things that God can make, all that which mirrors or images or reflects or participates in his goodness. And the scriptures say that when God created the world, all of it, he created all things, what? Very good. So the divine idea that was decreed, God made, all that God made, it was all very good. The nature God gave to everything in creation was good. God's good ideas became good realities. Well, those good realities image or imitate God's perfection, especially man, who has intellect and will and power and righteousness and holiness. So man is the image of God in a way that the rest of creation is not. And yet the rest of creation does display and declare God's glory. So God's goodness is imaged or imitated in all of creation, but man occupies it in a special way. That's just qualifying the language a little bit so we don't misunderstand it. But the argument so far is that all that God created is good. The divine idea is good. The thing created was good. Indeed, very good. The confession refers us here to 1 John chapter 1 and verse 5, where John says, "This then is the message we have heard of him and declare unto you that God is light, and in him is no darkness at all." So if God decreed all things in himself, then the divine idea that was decreed is a good idea, and the thing created was a good creation. A God who is light does not create darkness, understanding light and darkness to be truth and falsehood, good and evil. So evil does not come from God. God is not the author of evil. A God who is light creates light. So we can ask, in what ways does God know or not know evil? Well, here we have some helpful quotations from William Ames. William Ames said, "There are in God ideas of all perfections which are in the creatures, because they proceed from the active power of God, but not of imperfections, if they be formally considered as imperfections." Let's pause here. So Ames is saying God's ideas are perfect and all that he makes is good. Whatever comes from God's active power, everything that he creates and makes is a pure and good thing. So are there ideas of imperfect or impure beings in God? No. God is not the author of twisted or deformed or impure beings, but rather of a good creation. So the imperfections, if we narrow our focus down to the imperfections themselves, considered as imperfections, to use Ames' language, are not in God's divine idea. So in what way does God know them? In what way does God know evil? Ames then says, "The knowledge of evil depends upon the denying of good, as the being of evil consists in the privation of good. For everything, as it has its being, so it is known." You know a thing based on its being, but evil is not a being. It's not a substance. And so God does not know evil as a divine idea or as something that can be created. How does God know evil? God knows it as the good which can be denied, the good which can be privated or taken away. from creatures. Evil is the privation or the of a good or the lack of a good that should be present. So God's knowledge of evil is a knowledge of the good that can be denied by creatures or absent from creatures. In other words, evil does not come from God, whose ideas are all good creatures, but God creates creatures who can fall away from that goodness of their own volition. It's kind of like Lego sets, where each Lego set on the front, it shows a complete Lego set. That's the idea of the Lego set. And each and every one has an idea, it has a plan, it has a set of instructions that this is the set. Well, you can also break that set apart. You can also take those pieces and rearrange them into something awful or something different. And so God knows that in the divine idea, God knows all things that can imitate his perfection, that can reflect his goodness. But God also knows not deformed and imperfect and impure creatures as a divine idea, but the ways in which his creatures can possibly fall from the goodness that he has created in them. And therefore, God's knowledge of evil is not knowing evil as a thing, but rather knowing how his creatures can fall away from the original goodness that he gave to them. So we can say, and I put this in your handout, we can say that God has a foreknowledge of the defective acts and deformed natures of creatures as individual human possibilities yet to be actualized. So God did not make defective creatures. God did not make bad creatures. God did not make evil. But God knows how those creatures can fall away from the good, and he has a foreknowledge of how they will fall away from the good and his will to permit it. So God knows the defective acts and deformed natures of creatures as individual human possibilities that they can fall away from the good, the original goodness of his creation. And God knows the evil nature and willing of creatures not as an idea that comes from him, as something he created, but as the privation of good in his creatures, which happens by their own willing and by his wise permission. And that's what Ames is saying, that the knowledge of evil depends on the denying of good. And so God knows all the ways in which good can be denied or absent, all the ways in which good can be denied by his creatures or absent from his creatures. Now, do the scriptures speak like this? Well, we already read 1 John 1:5, where God is light and in him there's no darkness at all. So the divine idea, which is then created, which is decreed, cannot have sin as a thing in itself. Sin is a falling away from God's goodness. And it's not wrong to be created in a way that is able to fall. That's simply lacking a glorification that God will give to his creatures at a future time. But man was created good and able to fall and did fall. But the connection I want to make is that the scriptures elsewhere speak of sin as something that did not come from the mind of God. Which means, again, evil is not a thing that God decrees as a thing in itself, but it is a privation of good. So for what I'm referring to is in Jeremiah, three times, chapter 7, verse 31, chapter 19, verse 5, chapter 32, verse 35, three different times, the sin of burning one's children is mentioned. Of course, that sin is mentioned other times in the scriptures, but these verses mention the Israelite practice imitating the nations of sacrificing your children by burning them to the gods. And God says about this sin, he says, which I did not command, nor did it come into my mind. God says, whose idea was it to burn your children? He says, I did not command it. It did not come from my mind. It came from you falling away from my goodness. It came from you abandoning my law. Who came up with this idea? Sinful man, not God. Does God know it by foreknowledge of how creatures can fall away from his goodness? Yes. Did God decree this sin as an idea from him? No. So the confession says that God decreed in himself all things, and that God is not the author of sin, because God decreed to create good creatures which were able to fall away from their goodness, and which chose to fall away from their original goodness. This then leads to another question. But doesn't the decree of God include the sinful actions of men? And does not God therefore participate in the sin of their actions, which he has decreed to permit? And the confession says no. And it cites James chapter 1 and verse 13, which says, "Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man." So God cannot be tempted with evil, neither does he tempt anyone. How is this so? If sin is a part of God's decree, and yet God is not the author of sin, nor hath fellowship with any therein. Well, in order to answer that question, how man's sin is a part of God's decree, but God has no fellowship with man in sin, in order to prove that assertion, we have to do a lot more construction of the conceptual framework that leads to that conclusion. And so we're going to press pause on that question. How does God's decree and man's sin, how do they go together? We're going to come back to it. So I'm going to set that aside on the shelf, say wait, and we'll come back. We need to first do some more groundwork, which leads us to our second heading. We've seen that evil is not a divine idea. It's man's ideas falling away and abandoning God's goodness. And God has a foreknowledge of how man can and will do this and decrees to permit it. But we need to look now at the nature of second causes. The nature of second causes. I remember in 2007, I was asked to teach on this for our church's high school Sunday school class, which goes through the confession. And I looked at this. I didn't know what this meant. I needed to teach about it, and I remember calling my dad and asking him questions. And I looked back at my notes from then, and it wasn't that bad, actually. But I think it's a little bit. I think the confession's a little bit rude. The confession's a little bit rude. It just talks about second causes and assumes you know what they are. You say, but what are second causes? Is the confession rude? No, of course. But it is relying on a knowledge of things outside of the confession. And so, in order to understand what second causes are, we have to do a little bit more work. So, think of the term second cause. It implies the existence of what? A first cause. Or first causes. But the truth is, there's only one first cause, and that's God. So don't think, okay, there are first causes, and there are second causes. Nope. There's one first cause, which is God, and then all the not God causes, those are second causes. So God is the first cause of all things, but God created the world, God decreed the world in such a way that there are non-God causes. There are creatures who do things and effect things, and we're going to discuss three different kinds of causes that God's decree establishes instead of taking away. So the nature of second causes, which are not God causes. Number one, there are necessary causes. God has made the world in such a way, God has decreed the world in such a way that some things occur by necessity. They happen necessarily. For example, if you jump, what happens? You fall. God created the world in such a way that there is a law of gravity, that masses exert forces on other masses, and in proportion to the size of the mass, the greater the gravitational pull. And so that's why the sun being so big holds planets around it. That's why our Earth being so big keeps us on it. Because God created the world in such a way that gravity works by necessity. It necessarily causes things. It is a necessary cause. Why does gravity work? Why is it a thing? Because God decreed the world with necessary causes in it. When you fall to the earth, is God pushing you down? Is God pulling you down to the earth? Would you say, God's throwing me at the earth when I jump? No, you'd say, God created a world with necessary causes, one of which is gravity, and I jumped. I jumped, and so I fell. So if you don't want to fall, you don't jump. If you're on earth, and you jump, and when you jump, gravity doesn't pull you down, you're a superhero. You're breaking the laws, the necessary causes and laws of the world that God has created. And we live in a world of predictability and stability with normal and regular forces and laws because that is God's design and decree. Is our world just some chaos of confusion where nothing works and nothing is ever constant? No, mathematics and science and physics, all these sciences and more, they rely upon necessary causes that always do the same thing. Why do they always do the same thing? Because God decreed them in such a way. But not everything God decreed happens by necessity. Not all causes are necessary causes. Which brings us in the second place to free causes. God has created the world, God has decreed the world in such a way that while some things happen by necessity or some causes work by necessity, others are free to happen or not happen. Free means something can happen or cannot happen. It may happen, it may not happen. All of these might not causes are free causes, free to happen or not to happen. Think about your heartbeat. You may think that your heart beats by necessity, but it doesn't. Why? Because it began and it can stop. Your heart can stop beating at any moment. By God's kind providence, our hearts ordinarily beat until the later part of our lives, but the heart could stop at any moment. There's nothing necessary about my heartbeat. It's a free cause. There's no law of gravity. Remember, gravity doesn't take vacations. There's never a moment where gravity's not applying. Even zero-G situations, it's not that gravity's not applying. It's just you've escaped the pull of you've sufficiently escaped the pull of a massive object. Or you are in such a way maintaining an equilibrium of free fall for orbit. There's the word. Anyway, the point is gravity always works by necessity. Something like a heartbeat does not work by necessity. It could stop. Free causes include our decisions. If you're here at this conference, it's because you chose to come here. If you've been abducted, please speak with the deacons during the break. You were free to come here or not come here. Every single one of you could stand up and walk out the door right now if you wanted to. I won't be offended. Our decisions are free causes. God has made us in such a way that I'm able to pick up this Bible, I'm able to put it back down. I'm choosing to speak the words that I speak to you right now. We have decided to be at this place. We could have decided not to be at this place. These are free causes. I'm causing the raising of this Bible. I'm causing the setting of it down. You are causing your presence here, etc. We're causing. We're agents. Why are we able to do these things? Because God decreed the world with second causes, such as free causes, which may or may not happen. They're free. And every day, all day, there is to us an incalculable quantity of free causes going on in the world. This brings us, thirdly, to contingent causes. Contingent causes. God has decreed the world in such a way that some things happen by coincidence or contingency or chance, which does not mean that God's decree and providence are not guiding these things, but rather they take place without the intent of an agent. It's something that happens without a choice. It's something that just happens. We call them chance or coincidences. So one of the classic examples is in 1 Kings chapter 22, where King Ahab is killed by an arrow. And it says in chapter 22, verse 34, "But a certain man drew his bow at random and struck the king of Israel between the scale armor and the breastplate." So you have a variety of causes operating here. You have the free cause of the archer's choice to loose his arrow. It was a free cause. He chose to aim it up and to loose it. You see the necessary causes of physics, aerodynamics, and gravity that allow the arrow to go up, to lose its momentum, to be pulled down to the earth by gravity, and to fly downward. Those are necessary causes. But ultimately, the effect is a contingency. It's a chance. It's a coincidence. Ahab, in particular, gets killed. Did the archer shoot at Ahab? Was the archer saying, "I'm going to kill Ahab"? It says he shot at random. He aims his bow up and the arrow falls on Ahab. So we would say this is a contingent cause. It is something that took place apart from the intent or the decision of any agent. And there's many things that happen in this world without necessity. They didn't have to happen. And they happened without intent. No one was trying to make this outcome come out or take place. They do happen by various causes. There are contingencies that are bringing it about. It's not free of all causation or causality. It is contingent, but without intent. So we speak of accidents. I didn't mean for that to happen. There's unintended consequences or unintended effects that happen all the time. One of the reasons why we give our toddlers sippy cups, plastic cups with lids, is because we know whatever their intent may be, it may happen that they just drop it, even though they may even try. And many times your children will make promises, I won't drop it, Dad, I won't drop it, but it still happens. They didn't intend for that to happen. And they should have maybe been more careful. We teach them things like that. But parents also realize stuff happens. Contingencies happen, doesn't it? Because there are necessary causes, there are free causes, and all of this and more combine to create contingencies and chance. It's why we use things like dice. Because no one, as long as it's not loaded dice, no person can intentionally cause the side of the dice that they want to appear. There's too many contingencies for any agent to control that outcome. And if you do control it, you're cheating, right? That's why we talk about chance and probability in things like rolling dice or casting lots. And that's why the Proverbs say that casting lots is a good way to end certain matters, because two people know no one person imposed their will on the other. It was without the intent of an agent the lot was cast with intent, but the result is not one person's will over the other person's will. So if you say, where should we go out to eat or what should we have for dinner? And no one can decide, just flip a coin. It's fine. Then no one's mad at the other for forcing their way. And if you're in a church vote, just flip a coin. No, don't do that. That should be done by intent. Free cause, but not a contingency. So it is, sometimes people think as Calvinists, we shouldn't talk about chance. And we, of course, understand that God's providence guides all things according to his decree. But God has made the world in such a way that there is contingency. There is chance. It's not chance apart from God's decree. It's God has decreed there is chance. You see what I mean? He's created contingencies and contingent causes. And we have to account for them all the time. That's why we have car insurance. So God made the world in such a way that some things act by necessity, they're necessary causes. Some things act freely, do it or not do it. Some things happen contingently. It took place, but no one intended for this to happen. This leads us, thirdly, to the liberty of second causes. There's still always the whatabouts. Okay, we've come this far, but do not all second causes simply do what God has decreed they will do? If that's the case, then there's really just the first cause and no second causes. Well, no, there is a true liberty in second causes by God's decree. But we need to understand what is the nature of this liberty. What is the nature of the liberty of second causes? And in the first place, it's a dependent liberty. It's a dependent liberty. The liberty of second causes is not an absolute liberty. Remember, absolute means without relation, on its own. God did not give creatures a liberty without relation to himself. God gave creatures a liberty that's dependent on himself. God gave us a liberty that is dependent on his decree, that is dependent on his sustaining of all things. And it's actually here that most people get tripped up. They think that it must be absolute liberty or it is no liberty at all. But the liberty of second causes does not consist in an ability to act apart from God's causality, apart from God decreeing and ordaining all things. If we could cause, if we had the power to cause absolutely, in other words, without relation to God, what would we be? We would be gods. We would have first cause power because we can just effect things. But however much I try to make Oreos appear in my hand, it never works. And no matter how much I try to snap half the beings in the universe out of existence, I just can't do it. Nor would I want to. But the point is, my freedom, in order to be freedom, does not need to be absolute freedom. It's a dependent freedom. It depends on God decreeing this world and sustaining it and giving me agency within my created boundaries, which we'll talk about in just a moment. So it's a dependent liberty. It is a freedom. It is a liberty that depends on God's decree. It's established by God's decree. Secondly, the liberty of second causes corresponds to or fits with our being and nature. It's a liberty that matches who and what I am. God has given me freedom within or to the extent of what I can do. So all that I can know and all that I can will based on what I know, that is my correspondent liberty. My freedom corresponds to who and what I am. If it's beyond my comprehension or beyond my power, I cannot do it because I cannot know it. So, for example, again, I couldn't make a table because I don't know how. I can't just, by pure willing, I cannot make the table. I need that knowledge. And man does have the power to make a table, but if I wanted to make a planet, I can't do that. I don't have the power. If I want to fly, if I say up, up, and away, I don't go anywhere because God didn't make me a flying being. He didn't give me that power. So my liberty corresponds. It goes as far as what God made me to be. I can know as much as I can know, and I can do as much as I can do based on who and what I am. No amount of willing on my part can exceed those boundaries. Again, if my will could exceed those boundaries, I would be a first cause. My liberty is, it corresponds. It matches. It fits with how God made me. Humans can only do certain things. We can only know and act within the scope or the reach of what we are. But rather than emphasize the limitation, I want to also emphasize the reality. I can act within the scope of my knowledge and my power. And the scriptures speak of us this way many times. Genesis 31:29, it is in my power to do you harm. Strange to say it, but if I wanted to, I could hit any one of you, and you could hit me. We have that power. Daniel 11:36, and the king shall do all as he shall do as he wills. King, if you want to launch your army, launch your army. King, if you want to build a building, build the building. He can do those things. Perhaps by delegation, but he has power to effect certain things. 2 Samuel 7, verse 3, Nathan said to the king, go, do all that is in your heart. So God made us in such a way that our liberty corresponds with our nature, but we're able to do everything within the scope of who and what we are. Free to do these things. I may not be able to fly, but I can walk, and I can swim, and I can run, and I can sit, and I can stand, because God made me that way. But I can't breathe underwater. And I can't fly. Then how did you get here if you can't fly? Other second causes. And the providence of God. I try not to think about 37,000 feet up in the air, 600 miles per hour. Oh dear. But because of necessary causes, flights like that are predictable and stable and actually quite safe in the vast majority of cases. Anyway, we've already said that. So the liberty of second causes, it consists in a dependence upon God, not a freedom from God. It consists in a correspondence with our nature, the way God made us, just like fish can't fly and they can't breathe out of water. We can't breathe underwater and we can't fly. Everything acts according to how God made it. It is therefore, in the third place, a concurrent liberty. Our freedom concurs with God's decree. It concurs with God, the first cause. So think of concurrence, things that concur. They run together, something that is concurrent. Two things side by side that run together. They go together. God is the first cause of all things as the one who has decreed all things. That's the first part of this concurrence. But God has decreed to create agents, whether necessary causes, free causes, or contingent causes, with a dependent and correspondent liberty. And the scriptures teach that there is a concurrence between the first cause and all second causes. They run together. Which is to say, men act freely in accordance with the scope of their volition, all that they can will, based on their knowledge and power. Men do all that they can do, and God sovereignly accomplishes his purposes through all that they do. The first cause concurs with second causes. They run together. Man is willing all that man can will and doing all that he can do based on all that he can know. And God is accomplishing his eternal decree through all of their free actions. We see this in the scriptures again and again. Let me quickly quote some verses to you. Proverbs 19:21, many are the plans in the mind of a man, but it is the purpose of the Lord that will stand. Man is planning freely, but what ultimately takes place is the purpose of the Lord. James 4:13-15, come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit, yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. So man is making decisions, and it is God's will that is ultimately bringing about the result, is guiding all things to their appropriate end. Genesis 50, verse 20, very well known, always quoted in these contexts for good reason. Joseph says to his brothers, as for you, you meant evil against me. They chose to do evil. They did evil against Joseph, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. Joseph's brothers made their choices. They acted within the scope of their volition, and God accomplished his will. There's a concurrence. Acts chapter 2, verse 23. This Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. They chose to crucify. They chose to kill according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. We could cite additional verses. I think we have the time to do that. Acts chapter 4, verses 27 and 28. It says, for truly in this city there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the people of Israel, to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place. Herod, Pilate, Gentiles, Israelites, all of them, they gathered together, they conspired, they chose, they decided, they acted according to God's plan. John chapter 19, verse 11, you would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given to you from above. So God's causality or God's decree and man's freedom, they concur. They go together. Man freely chooses, man freely acts, and God accomplishes his will, God accomplishes his purposes through the free actions of man. And through all the second causes of creation. We're narrowing our scope to man, but it's actually a fact that God, the first cause, concurs with all second causes. They run together. These verses show that men plan freely, but God fulfills his own will through them. It's not a zero-sum game. Either God does everything and it's God that does it, or man does it and not God. That's how people usually think. Either God does it or man does it. And the fact is, man makes his choices and takes action, and God is sovereignly, according to his decree, working out his own purposes at the same time in a concurrence. Or sometimes you'll see the Latin word used, concursus. This is the concurrence of the first cause with second causes. And this doctrine of concurrence rescues us from between the sword and the wall. You feel, oh no, I'm backed up against the wall. What do I do? How do I avoid this question of, did God do it or did I do it? You did it, and God is sovereignly working out his purposes through your actions. If we think there's only one kind of liberty, then we'll think that we have to be a first cause or we're not a cause at all. But second causes enjoy a dependent liberty, a correspondent liberty, which is concurrent to the first cause. So now, having reconstructed some of the conceptual framework behind the confession's affirmations, we can return to the question of when man sins, does God have fellowship in the sin? When man sins, when man chooses to sin, is God somehow responsible? So in the fourth place, we'll look at the decree in sin and consider four points leading to a conclusion. In the first place, remember that sin is a defect. Sin is a defect. Think about effects and defects. What make effects, or what cause effects, and what cause defects? Efficient causes create effects. They effect the thing that they intend. They cause it. Deficient causes cause defects. Efficient causes cause effects. Deficient causes cause defects. Well, sin is a straying from the mark. Sin is lawlessness. Sin is, God has commanded this, you go a different way. Sin is a defect. And therefore, sin always has a deficient cause. God always accomplishes His purpose perfectly. God cannot be a deficient cause. God cannot sin. God cannot make a mistake. God cannot do something wrong. God being a perfectly efficient cause, because He's omnipotent, He perfectly effects all things. There's no power that He's subject to that causes Him to make a mistake or to there's no contingencies leading Him to say, I didn't intend that. God is a perfectly efficient cause, and therefore God causes effects. But man is a deficient cause and causes defects. Sin is a defect, therefore it has a deficient cause. So therefore we can say God never sins, nor can God sin. But sinners can sin because God upholds their agency or their efficiency. God created creatures that can cause defects, and He upholds their agency to do so. Remember, we have a dependent liberty. God has established our liberty, and within our nature is within our power to defectively cause things, which is to sin. But God can do no sin because it is a defect caused by a deficient cause. So therefore, when man sins, if we ask, did God do it? No, it's a defect. God is an efficient cause. Well then, doesn't this take place in God's decree? Yes. So in the second place, God permits sin. God permits sin. God does not cause sin in us. God does not sin through us. God does not approve sin. But God does permit sin to happen. He doesn't permit it in the sense of, it's okay for you to do it. God allows it to happen. And this is another one of those big tripping points. Why does God permit sin? We'll actually come back to that a little bit, but we need to say here that God is not obligated to provide every possible good for every creature, which would prevent them from sinning. If sinning is a falling away from the good, a deprivation of good, God is not obligated to supply the good that's lacking or about to be lacking to prevent the sinner from sinning. Why does God have to prevent the sinner from sinning? What obligation is He under to provide that good for them that would keep them from falling away to sin? Therefore, if God permits evil, God is not culpable for the evil done because He was not responsible to prevent it. If it pleases the Lord in His wisdom to withdraw from Pharaoh and allow his heart to harden, God is free to do that. It says God hardened Pharaoh's heart, which means God withdraws from Pharaoh and denies to him the good that would keep Pharaoh from hardening his own heart. When God withdraws from him, Pharaoh hardens his own heart. God is not responsible for what Pharaoh does in the hardness of his own heart. God is not obligated to prevent Pharaoh from hardening his own heart. If God forbids sin, which He does, and if God does not tempt man to sin, which He does not, and if God is not obligated to prevent man's sin, which sometimes He does, but He does not have to, then God has no fellowship with sinners in their sin when He permits it. They choose to do it, and they do it, and He permits it. But He has not done it, nor is He responsible for it. Sin, therefore, in the third place, is the result of man's free choices to sin. Why do sinners sin? Because they want to, and they choose to. The law of God declares to us the good that God requires, and sin is lawlessness. It is not doing the good that God requires. It's a deprivation. It's a negation of good. As 1 John 3:4 says, sin is lawlessness. It's the omission of doing the good which we ought to do, or the commission of the evil that we ought not to do. So man freely chooses the not good that God has commanded. God compels no one to sin. Disobedience does not come from God. It comes from God's creatures, as they contemplate something that is not God as the source of good, and thus choose themselves instead of God, loving themselves over God. This was the fallen angels and Adam's original sin, to look somewhere other than God for their good and to seek good in it. And their disobedience, both in angels and men, was the result of their own free choices. As we already read or heard from Jeremiah, that Judah's horrific murder of its children, passing them through the fire, where did it come from? God says, I did not command this, nor did it ever enter into my mind. Where did it come from? From the own perverted and twisted, deformed nature of sinners who conceived of such wickedness, and God permitted it. From the first sin until now, sin comes from the free choices of creatures who have a true liberty to act. And God permits those free choices and actions for His own ends and purposes. Even in a fallen state of corruption, man freely chooses to murder, to commit adultery, to steal, to lie, to covet, etc. And though man cannot please God in his fallen condition, man can choose to be civically obedient, to not lie, to not murder, to not covet, to not steal. His heart is inclined towards those things, certainly. But are our neighbors at all times trying to murder us and steal from us? No, they can freely choose not to do those things. It can never rescue them from their sinful condition or the guilt that they lie under, but they can choose not to sin in a sense. Even their best outward works are still sinful and tinged with sin, but the overall point is that sin is the result of man's free choices. God does not have fellowship with man because God does not compel man to sin. Man sins of his own free choice. God upholds his agency and permits the sin of man, which he is not obligated to prevent. But why would God permit such horrendous acts and wickedness in this world? Well, our confession tells us in chapter 5 that God's permission is not a bare permission. It's not like the Proverbs say that it is the glory of a man to remain aloof from controversy. So that's why you shouldn't be on social media in a lot of seriousness. We often just don't want to know. Don't tell me. I don't want to know. That's not God's permission of sin. God doesn't say, okay, whatever. It's not a bare permission. I'm going to let it happen and not look. It's not a bare permission. God bounds and guides sin to accomplish His purposes, His good, wise, and holy ends. We've already seen this in Joseph's brothers, who intended evil, and God used it for good. Peter told the Jews that in their wickedness they murdered the Christ, and yet God accomplished a foreordained purpose of salvation. So there is concurrence even in man's sin. The first cause is still working out his purposes even in the permission of sin. There's a wonderful illustration used by John Norton, and I use it as often as I can, or as often as I have reason to, where he talks about a mill, a water-powered mill. And if you look at water running in the course of a channel or a river or a brook, water does what water does, and it runs according to its course. Water stays in its lane, and it follows the channel. That's what water is. If you took a scoop of the water or studied the water, does it produce anything? You'd say, no, it's in itself. The water's just water, and water does water things. Very good, thank you. But then you have a mind who builds a mill on the edge of the water and puts a water wheel into the water. And now this water wheel begins to power a mill, and the mill begins to grind meal and produce flour. Or perhaps the water wheel is connected to a saw and it begins to saw logs. If you asked a scientist, you said, can water produce bread? Can water saw logs? They'd say, no, that's ridiculous. Water in and of itself cannot produce those things. But in the mind of a miller, they can produce things that water in itself could never produce. So God's permission of sin is not a bare permission, but rather God in His wisdom, in His sovereignty, in His decree, He permits sin and yet guides it and bounds it to produce goods that sin in and of itself could never produce. Sin is just sin. It's bad. It's a deprivation of good. And when we look at sin and suffering, we should acknowledge it as this is bad. This is evil. This is wicked. This is horrendous. But we take much comfort in the fact that in God's decree, though He permits sin, He also bounds and guides it to produce goods that sin in and of itself could never produce. And so God's permission of sin, God is not the author of sin, and God has no fellowship with sinners, and yet God does use the sin of man to accomplish even His holy and wise purposes. This is why someone or this is why James can say something like, count it all joy, brethren, when you encounter trials of various kinds. He's not saying the trial is joyous, but he's saying that the trial, the water, can be put to a wheel, which can be put to a mill or a saw, and it can create something good. It can bring about something good. Count the trial as that which can lead you to joy. Count the trial as a water mill, which can produce a good that the trial in itself is not good, but it can produce a good in God's wisdom and in your submission to God's providence. Well, in conclusion, we've seen that God is not the author of sin because the divine ideas are good, or the divine idea is good. And God only knows the corruption and deformity of man by foreknowledge of the sins which man will freely choose and God will sovereignly permit. We've seen that God decreed the world in such a way that there are necessary free and contingent causes that have a dependent and correspondent liberty that is concurrent with God's decree. God is the first cause which accomplishes his purposes through the free choices of his creatures. And we've seen that God has no fellowship with sinners because sin is a defect caused by a deficient cause, which God cannot be or do. And God's decree reaches to sin by permitting it, not as an end in itself, but in concurrence as a means to a good end, the glory of his own name and the good of his people. So our confession of faith makes assertions, but not without reason. There are underlying arguments from the literature and from the scriptures that help us to reinforce and defend and prove these statements which we confess, and I hope that this lesson has contributed somewhat to a deeper and fuller understanding of why we confess these things. When we come back in the next session, we'll look at paragraph 2 of the confession, and we'll also look at a portion of paragraph 1 that we have not yet looked at specifically.